Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 15, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is on Venezuela, the road forward. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us an all-star cast to discuss this subject, and our moderator today is Ambassador Grover Joseph Reese, who is an attorney, advocate, and former United States Ambassador to East Timor. After our speakers give their remarks today, we will have an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for this topic or for one of our speakers in particular. Thank you all very much for sharing with us today. Ambassador Reese, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Wesley. Of the many festering crises around the world involving dictatorships and failed states and other kinds of problems that other countries have to pay attention to, very few have been as enduring as that of Venezuela. Venezuela has been a problem for a long time, ever since the regime of Hugo Chavez. His successor, Nicolas Maduro, has acted in many respects as a dictator. His elections and other elections in Venezuela have been problematic. But until recently, his opposition and nations around the world, including the United States, recognized the legitimacy, the technical legitimacy of the Maduro regime. The 2018 election changed that. There was a general consensus that Maduro had not won the election. And therefore, the National Assembly, which was controlled by the opposition, invoked an article of the Venezuelan Constitution that said when the presidency is vacant, the president of the National Assembly becomes the interim president. That president, President Guaido, has now been recognized by the great majority of the countries in the world who've taken a position at all. Been recognized by the Organization of American States, by almost all countries in the Western Hemisphere, the great majority of them, and even by almost all of the countries in the European Union. Predictably, there are a few countries on the other side still supporting the de facto government of Nicolas Maduro. They include China, Russia, Cuba, and a couple of others like Syria, Bolivia, Iran, the ones that you would expect. But those are important countries, and they've got positions on the Security Council, so Maduro still sits in the United Nations. The economy is a disaster. There are links to organized crime. The UN Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights recently reported that the Maduro regime has engaged in thousands and thousands of extrajudicial killings and then covered them up. This really is a crisis. But the question is, what do we do about it? Suggested solutions range from strategic patience, which was generally the policy of the Obama administration, to outside military intervention. We have three expert panelists, experts in more ways than one. Rodrigo Diamanti is the president of an organization called Un Mundo Sin Mordaza, that is, a world without censorship. He is a Venezuelan. He was based in Venezuela until 2015 when he was detained by the government and had to escape from the country. The second panelist is Colonel Jose Gustavo Arocha, who a dissident military officer who was arrested and held for 8 months in detention by the government, during which time he was tortured. He also managed to escape in 2015. He's now based in the United States. And the third panelist is Ambassador Roger Noriega, who has served both as U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States and also as Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere and has been dealing with Venezuela for a long time. I'm going to turn it over to our panelists, beginning with Rodrigo Diamanti.
Thank you, Ambassador Reese. For me, it's an honor, and thank you for taking the time to talk about what is happening in Venezuela. You already mentioned this fight for democracy and freedom have taken more than we ever thought. And now we not only have to deal with a dictatorship, but we also have to deal with a humanitarian emergency, refugee crisis, crimes against humanity, drug trafficking, too many problems at the same time for just one country and for the opposition in Venezuela. They have to deal with all of this and try to survive at the same time. So I've been fighting for human rights since I was 18. Now I'm almost 36. So it's 18 years since Chavez arrived to power that we knew that we were going to the wrong direction, but we never could even imagine that we could have arrived to this level of destruction of a nation. We're talking about the richest nation in South America that had been transformed in the poorest nation in the continent, and with the economical contraction never seen before, not even after World War II in Germany. So basically, it's a nation that has been destroyed, where next year we're expecting, right now we have 4 million Venezuelans outside the country that had to escape because of all this crisis, but we're expecting, if we don't find a solution, to have at least 10 million by next year. That's one-third of the country's population. So basically, at this point, yes, we have the very important report from Michelle Bachelet, the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the UN, but this report is just a tool to increase the pressure to the nations that we need sanctions, not only from the U.S., that they have been very effective against the regime, but also from all the countries of the European Union and all the countries of Latin America, in order to increase the pressure in Venezuela. Also, we need the International Criminal Court to start a formal investigation right away. We don't understand why the prosecutor at the court is not fulfilling the mission of the court and hasn't started investigation against the regime when she has all the proof that crimes against humanity have been committed in Venezuela. And of course, we need to exercise international jurisdiction, try to trial members of the dictatorship in other courts, in other jurisdictions, in other countries for international crimes being committed by the members of the regime. So at this point, there is a lot to do on diplomatic level that we are still waiting, and that's our position, or at least my position as a human rights activist that needed to escape the country 4 years ago because I also suffered the persecution, even a kidnap from the regime, and forced me to leave my lovely country.
Thank you for that opening statement. We'll have time to ask some questions later to get you to give some more details. I'd like now to ask Colonel Arocha for his thoughts.
Thank you, Ambassador. Venezuela is living its darkest hours. The humanitarian apocalypse has hit more than 4 million people, and several hundred have been unjustly and unlawfully detained and tortured in my country. I am one of those Venezuelans. I am a torture survivor, and thank God that the United States gave me another opportunity to live free. However, when I'm here talking, there are still almost 1,000 other Venezuelan political prisoners currently being tortured and even murdered for the only crime of dreaming of a free country. What is happening in Venezuela is the result of an evil process. Indeed, when I was 16 years old, I met Mayor Hugo Chavez giving a speech to the freshman class of the military cadets. He was already building his Casa of Rock military officers who served their own ideals and interests rather than those of Venezuela. Chavez seduced middle-rank officers to incite a failed coup in 1992, but later rose to power in 1999 and immediately began to corrupt the Venezuelan army through increasingly placing undeserved loyalist officers in high-ranking positions of leadership across state companies and non-security-related state ministries. At this moment, I realized that the destruction of Venezuela could be the Chavez's biggest legacy. In July 2002, In the wake of the failed coup, I was the commander of the senior cadets at the military academy in Caracas. I saw high-ranking military officers participating in partisan activities, labeling dissidents as enemies, and even confronting civilians with force. At the same time, Chavez started to corrupt and criminalize the Venezuelan military by connecting some to the FARC and other criminal actors involved in drug trafficking, illegal mining, extortion, and kidnapping, all under military protection. Chavez was motivated and inspired by the other revolutions around the world. His Bolivarian Revolution was always meant to link to anti-American revolutions, namely in Iran. When I was working in Cabin from 2005 to 2008, which is the Venezuelan's military industry, Chavez closed the door to the United States and opened up military and security cooperation with the two aces of evil, namely Cuba, China, Russia, and Iran, not only as investor in Venezuela's energy and mining sectors, but also the principal suppliers of lethal military aid as well as cybersecurity, all to help his pursuit of total popular and social control of the country. For example, Russia sold around $12 billion in arms to Venezuela. China sold about $1 billion in weaponry and launched $63 million in total, to include three spy satellites. Iran engaged in covert military projects dealing with drones and chemical plants. Russia, China, and Iran support the asymmetric strategic in Venezuela and have done so for a long time. In fact, for the last 15 years, these countries have engaged in high-level military intelligence, communications, and security cooperation with Venezuela. In 2009, my military career came to an end because of persecutions. But when Chavez died in 2013 and Maduro took power, it only got worse for the Venezuelans. Under Maduro, Venezuelan military officers loyal to Chavismo forced closer alliance with the terrorist factions such as Hezbollah and ELN, and criminal structure emerged such as the Cartel of the Suns. Combine these illicit actors control upwards of the 7% of the territory and resources. These illicit activities have enriched high-ranking officers in the military, trickle down corruption among the lower rank, and create a de facto parallel state where systematic and well-documented environmental and human rights abuses occur with the regime's complicity. The current crisis in Venezuela goes beyond the results of an inept or inefficient government. The current crisis goes beyond just a criminal regime. The Bolivarian Revolution is meant to be utilized as a proxy conflict to forcibly displace millions of refugees to challenge the sovereignty of the neighboring states. The Bolivarian Revolution is a tool of asymmetric warfare. But the military cannot solve this challenge due to all the reasons I said before, and because they are constantly and continuously monitored by the external and external actors. There have been several years of house cleaning and repression of the Venezuelan military to the point that actually the Bolivarian Armed Force of Venezuela are part of the problem and not the solution. The military is a broken institution in my country. Thus, who will solve the crisis in Venezuela must understand that the country is kidnapped by extra-regional actors, namely Russia, Iran, China, and recently Turkey. This global power has decided that the destruction of many will benefit the few, and that the proxy war in Venezuela is necessary to defeat the United States and the Western world. Venezuela cannot solve this problem alone.
Thank you, Colonel Arocha, and Ambassador Noriega.
Great. Thank you very much, Ambassador Reese, for hosting this. And I thank my fellow panelists for laying a very good ground framework for the discussion. Let me say at the outset that what we're seeing, not only in Venezuela, but in neighboring Colombia, is actually a product of malign neglect on the part of the Obama administration, which, because it prioritized a process of opening up to the Castro regime through unilateral concessions, set aside what was happening in Venezuela and stood by while the Chavez and the Maduro regime were consolidating themselves, and actually, in the case of Colombia, stood by as a peace process was advanced that resulted in an explosion of coca that threatens the United States. And let me just say that while we are all very interested in and committed to the human rights implications of what's happening in Venezuela, as well as the refugee crisis, this is important to the United States precisely because, as was said, it's an asymmetrical challenge to U.S. security. This is a narco regime. It's not just another typical tropical dictator. It's a narco regime, Maduro's family being directly involved in narco trafficking, former Speaker of the House, the same former Minister of Interior also involved, state governors, virtually all of the generals involved, not only in the traditional forms of corruption, but being directly involved in moving cocaine and illicit gold through Venezuelan territory to other markets. And this is set against the backdrop of corruption, where they've eluded about a half a trillion dollars in revenue from the Venezuelan state. This is a regime that is armed by Russia, financed by China, micromanaged by Cuba, and exploited by transnational organized crime, by Iran, by Hezbollah, and Colombian guerrillas. It is not just a question of saving Venezuela and restoring democracy and human rights. This is about heading off a humanitarian disaster and confronting this transnational organized threat, which is abetted by our principal rivals or enemies, Russia and China and Cuba. And if we don't get ahead of the curve on this, it's going to swamp Colombia, an important economic and security partner in South America. It will continue the disintegration of institutions and stability in Central America, and sowing more disruption, more displacement of people that drives that threat that's right at our border in terms of a wave of illegal immigration, and will undermine security in Mexico. So this is really an important question for us. What's our policy up to now? It's essentially we're meeting this asymmetrical threat with conventional diplomacy. If tweets were hellfire missiles, this struggle would be over. President Trump identified Venezuela as a threat very early on and told his senior advisors he wanted to see a change. Unfortunately, when he said all options are on the table, the U.S. diplomats essentially backed off that. When they let off that pressure, it enticed the Russians to double down. The Chinese, who were ready to walk away from Maduro, essentially, came back in, reversed themselves, doubled down, and joined the Chinese. Joined the Russians. And for Cuba, this is an existential struggle, and they cannot afford to lose it. And they micromanage the affairs of Venezuela, running the internal security apparatus and really driving a lot of the political decisions within the regime. So that's what we're confronting. And that policy that we have of backing a constitutional solution around the interim president, Juan Guaido, I don't think is really up to the task, because the opposition itself is weak and it's discredited. It has a history of capitulation. We backed our policy up with targeted sanctions at individuals, and I think that's been a very sound strategy or tactic. And we've increased it by choking off oil revenue. Again, Treasury Department is driving this through the OFAC process, targeting sanctions at entities and individuals that are directly involved in the criminality. But I believe that the diplomacy has not been up to snuff. On April 30th, the State Department backed a power-sharing arrangement, which would have left narco generals and the vast majority of the regime in place to cohabitate with a weak figurehead of the interim president, Juan Guaido. That's just not sufficient. I'll talk a little bit about where we are now, and I think what options are on the table for us But with that initial comment, I'll stop.
Thank you so much, Ambassador. Your last sentence is provocative and is, I think, where we ought to go now. Everybody admits that this is a disaster. And it's not just conservatives in the United States and conservatives in Venezuela who feel that way. It's just about everybody in Latin America. It's the Organization of American States. It's almost everybody in the European Union. It's Michelle Bachelet, the former left-wing president of Chile, who's now the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Everybody admits it's a disaster. Everybody admits it needs a solution. The problem is that the solution that many Venezuelans are suggesting, which is to invoke Article 187 of their constitution, which says that the National Assembly can invite in foreign military forces, is exactly the thing that President Trump has said he's not going to do anywhere. And indeed, he may be right about that. Do we really want a war in Venezuela where superficially it's gringos, norteamericanos, against everybody else? And if we're not going to do that, and of course we'd end up fighting Cubans and maybe fighting Russians and Chinese in that situation. If we can't do that, what can we do that we haven't done? And I would like to ask Ambassador Noriega, but also the other panelists.
Okay, well, I'll be to the point so the others have an opportunity to comment. I agree with Senator Scott. Incidentally, there's a bipartisan consensus in Washington that Maduro has to go. He's illegitimate and he has to go. The principal Democratic leaders of the House and Senate have said, joined Republicans in saying that very thing. What Senator Scott has said is that we need to be prepared to use some sort of military pressure to get them out of there, to displace that regime. They are not going to voluntarily give up power, least of all through elections. And so they're looking at buying time. And what we have to calculate is, what are the costs of doing nothing? We have an international coalition essentially that's defined by what it's not willing to do to deal with the crisis. And so I think we need to look at real partners, coalition of willing nations that are willing to identify the Maduro regime as a criminal regime that has no legitimacy and that has to be removed. I think we can sharpen the point on this by indicting principal leaders of that regime. Already, I would say one of the troika in the Venezuelan leadership, Tarek El Asami, has been indicted in U.S. courts. Some of the cronies of the regime who have absconded with billions of dollars and keep that for the regime leaders have also been indicted or will be soon. But I think that we need to target the Maduro family, Diosdado Cabello, another leader of the regime. We need to indict these people, and we need to put rewards, substantial multi-million dollar rewards for their arrest or capture. And we need to work with leaders of other countries to identify Venezuelan patriots who are willing to fight for their country. Yes, we need to press the interim government to ask for a multinational coalition. It's really unconscionable that the current interim president of Venezuela has refused to do that. Why? Because the Americans are not comfortable with the use of force. He has an obligation in light of the humanitarian disaster that his people are confronting to do that. Request that multinational force and then have the international community hash out what it's willing to do. Also, that interim government needs to say to the leaders that they're prepared to pay for the multinational intervention. They have $4 billion frozen right now. This is an oil-rich country with recovered assets. Every country that participates in a multinational coalition to displace this regime should be reimbursed for the expenses that they incur. I think it needs to be led by Venezuelan patriots who want to carry that fight to the regime. We need to provide training and resources for them to do so, or we're going to end up with another Syria right in our hemisphere, with the impact right at our border.
Thank you, Ambassador. I'd like to ask the other two panelists to respond. But in particular, since you're both Venezuelans, how would the Venezuelan military react to the kind of multilateral effort that Ambassador Noriega has discussed? There was talk a few months ago that senior military leaders who were Chavistas were thinking about defecting, were thinking about compromising in some way. Would that happen, or would this harden the opposition?
Well, we have to remember that some of the threats of the Chavismo, they are looking to keep their criminal networks. Indeed, most of them are like Hugo Carvajal, is a known drug trafficking dealer, keeping. So I don't believe that the Chavismo is looking for really restore democracy in Venezuela. They are looking to restore or keep their networks. But I think that the military, especially the junior officers, who is going to have future in the new government, that they are willing to help and be helped by the any coalition after, as Ambassador Noriega said, that after the they have to be patriot to recover democracy in Venezuela, and after that it's necessary a coalition in order to deal with some threats like Hezbollah, ELN, FARC, because the military right now is totally broken and it's not possible to handle this threat by themselves.
Senor Diamante?
Well, I'm not a military expert. I'm more of a human rights activist. But I think we, as I mentioned before, we should go first to the diplomatic process or action that we haven't done. I think that discussion should come after that. I think after all members of, I agree with Ambassador Noriega that these members of the extradition should be indicted at the U.S. For their relationship with narcotraffic. All of them should be also prosecuted in other and tried in other countries using international conventions like Palermo and other tools that the international justice system already has that we haven't used. We should put pressure on the court to not only start a formal investigation, but to also to send an arrest order against the members of the dictatorship. And after that, we can find a way how to resolve this. I think I agree with Arocha and Ambassador Noriega that this is a criminal organization. I think even the title of dictatorship is too big for the members of the regime of Venezuela. I think they are just a criminal organization who has kidnapped Venezuela. But at this point, before we arrive to any type of military coalition, or we should think of where are the sanctions in Latin America for the member of the regime? Where are the sanctions in Europe? I think that will increase the tension inside the member of the regime to understand that they need to step down and allow President Guaido to call for election and recover democracy. I know that criminal organization, maybe this type of action is not enough, but I think that we need to do that first step before we think in further actions.
I have one other question before we turn to the audience. If there were a multilateral military effort, of course, the regime and its allies would portray it as an American effort, even if it were led primarily by others, even if it were a coalition of the genuinely willing. What would the Venezuelan people feel about that? Would they say what we thought the Iraqi people would say? Would they be baking cakes for the liberation forces, or would there be a nationalist backlash in support of the regime, support that it doesn't have now? And secondly, what would Russia, China, and Cuba do?
So I think that there will be not be a... So people are completely suffering right now in Venezuela. Just to last year, the average Venezuelan lost 11 kilos. I don't know how much is that in pounds, but it's a lot. And because there's no food, there's no water, there's no electricity. So I think people are despaired and they want a solution. And there's a lot of pressure for that. So I think the biggest enemy will not be the Venezuelans that need support right now. I think we should take care more about Cuba, as you said, or Russia or China at this point, and consider, you know, any type of response from them. Also, other members of guerrilla members that have their claws in Venezuela. But definitely, anything, I think it will be less costly than just leaving things how they are. As Ambassador Noriega also said, I think we are very close to not only completely lose Venezuela, but also this can make us lose Colombia, who already had as a former guerrilla that run for president and maybe could win the next 4 years And that's when you will have a problem, because you will have a completely Venezuela, you know, under control of a criminal group. But then you will have, again, these the all the producers of cocaine in Colombia who will be doing business with the government in Colombia and Venezuela at the same time. So basically, if we think that the problem is as big as Venezuela, I think that's the wrong point to see it. I think this is could be the problem, the tumor, the cancer that is right now in Venezuela can make metastasis and go and affect Colombia, who's already affected by 1.5 million Venezuela that has leave the country and live there and are collapsing the economy of Colombia. And with this collapse, you know, also Colombia can suffer political change and move forward the radical left and the criminals related to that left.
I think it's hard to ask people who is already kidnapped to say, well, do you want freedom? Of course they want to be free. And I think that it's hard for Venezuelan people right now. He's living despairing, desperation, because people, just imagine, people are immigrating without any, sometimes without any money, any food, anything. There's a lack of food, lack of medicines. They are dying, and they want to be free. I think they don't care who is going to give the freedom. But the real question, you said the real question, what about Russia, Cuba, Iran, and all these actors? I think that is the big problem. I think that is the help that they really Venezuela needs. And they need a strong power to say, well, you have to give it out of Venezuela. And that is not possible for the Venezuelan properly.
I think that's a very critical point. This is a big power issue. And the United States needs to get much tougher as part of the strategy I'm suggesting, to tell the Russians we're not going to allow them to sustain a criminal regime in our neighborhood and have a serious situation play out in our hemisphere. We need to tell the Cubans that if the U.S. were to intervene and one American were to be injured at the hands of the Cuban regime, that we will deal with that in Havana. I think essentially what I'm talking about is a Noriega type response, no pun intended. That is to say what we did in Panama. But I hasten to say I'm not minimizing the challenge. This is a serious security problems there. You have narco guerrillas that are well trained, that have nothing to lose. You have militias that are well armed. You have groups called colectivos, which are pro-regime gangs that are expert in sowing mayhem. And so that's why I think the United States would go in with other countries, deal with the conventional military challenge, which I think would be rather weak. We're talking about a military that's been decimated by its own corruption and, you know, soldiers who can't walk a mile because they don't have more than one meal a day, decimated units. You deal with those in a conventional way, and then you introduce the DEA with backed up by arrest groups that go in and arrest kingpins, because that's what we're talking about here. This is not a military per se. This is a criminal organization. You go in that way, but the bulk of that force should be a multinational force. Get some sort of a mandate from the United Nations or from the Organization of American States to maintain forces there as a police action, essentially to and immediately reactivate the economy, get the oil revenue flowing, so this can be a sustainable effort. But the tough, heavy lifting of dealing with the criminals in the country who are occupying that country should be done by Venezuelans, but they have to have our support.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to ask the technical folks if there are callers on the line who'd like to ask questions.
Absolutely, Ambassador. Looks like we do have three questions in the queue. Caller, you are up.
This is Karen Lugo, and first I'd like to thank you all for participating in this very informative discussion. I have a question regarding the other, what you've called proxy powers, but with the fact that Secretary Pompeo had announced that Maduro may be seriously considering stepping down, but that Russia had intervened to stop that impulse, and that China has, in fear of some of their investments and loans being back the way they had expected, actually taken partnership in some of the oil and support enterprises. With that kind of direct involvement in the country, how important is it that the United States is, I guess we would say, negotiating or putting pressure on the countries of Iran also, but China and Russia directly, as we're involved in other kinds of negotiations with those countries?
Let me just say, I think that first off, you need to have a credible team, and we need a new team leading the Venezuela policy who will deliver more credible messages to the Russians about where we're headed on our policy and have them make the judgments they need to make. But I don't think for a moment that the Russians want to go to war with the United States over Nicolas Maduro. I think they wanted to collect maybe $10 billion, maybe more, of their investment and make sure that that investment is safe. A successor government could make it very clear that people willing to do business in a transparent way or have made investments in Venezuela will recover those investments. That is certainly a message that the Chinese want to hear, and they understand that it's more likely they'll get back the money that they're owed from a new government of Venezuela or a new private sector run petroleum sector than they would get from the corrupt and incompetent regime of Maduro. I will say on the point about whether Maduro was ready to leave, that was in the context of an April 30 plot, which I believe that the Russians knew about 2 weeks earlier, before the April 30 date when it was supposed to come to fruition. The reason I think that they knew that is that I knew it. I heard about that plotting, and if I know it, the Russians knew it. And so what happened was that the opposition folks who were suckered in by the corrupt regime bagmen who helped put that plot together were essentially fooled. And I think that I have no doubt that somebody told Secretary Pompeo we were just that close to getting rid of Maduro, but I don't think it was ever the case. And it indicates really that you have a team that does not understand the complexity of the challenge in Venezuela, and we need a new leadership to deliver a message about a new policy.
I'd like to ask our Venezuelan panelists, if there were overwhelming force about to happen, would there be senior military defections, or at least enough military defections to change the balance of power inside Venezuela? And is there any possibility Maduro would go peacefully?
Well, I'm going to explain something about the military in Venezuela. That is a very important question. First of all, the professional military in Venezuela is a broken institution, which means we can see just individuals in a state of the court. A military is function when they act together as a corps, they have a maneuver, the companies, battalions, brigades, divisions under leadership, and they have communications, support. That is not happening in Venezuela. Venezuela, you have individuals wearing uniforms. That is a good example of the deflections. You say the deflections by people themselves, which means that, well, there's a captain or mayor, but there is not companies, there is not battalions, and there is just one guy, two guys, or several guys, but they're as an individuals. And that is not important in the military that you act like a Rambo. That is not important. The most important thing is you act as a corp, and that is not possible right now in Venezuela. That's why you see that the deflections, and there is not, Christopher, okay, but nothing happened because he's one of a group. That is not the group.
Next caller, you are up.
Thank you. My question is, what NGOs or charitable organizations or human rights organizations would you say are truly helping Venezuelans right now? And what can the average citizen do to pressure Maduro and help Venezuelans?
I suppose Rodrigo would say Unmundo Sin Mordaza is helping.
Yeah, that's the most important one. No, I think We have been working with, lately, at least this year, Amnesty International have been helping us to increase pressure to the ICC, to the International Court. I think at this point, the most important one is the OAS. If you tell me, we should support one institution that is doing everything to help Venezuela, is the OAS, the Organization for American States, conducted by Secretary General Luis Almagro, who have been the first person in a position of power since 2016 to talk about and explain what is happening. They have a group to work about and help refugees outside Venezuela. He's also conducting investigation about what Cuba is doing in Venezuela in order to increase the pressure against Cuba. They're also conducting investigation about crimes against humanity to reduce impunity and corruption. And so basically they're doing all the political level, international level, all the pressure to put all the countries in the direction to help Venezuela. Because as we all said, you have to be a multilateral solution. But I think that the biggest coordinator of this multilateral solution, of course, with the support of the U.S., Canada, and other important countries, had been the OAS and the Secretary General Luis Almagro. Then you have Human Rights Watch that also have done a wonderful job supporting us. But then, again, the best help to support Venezuela at this point is to really help us to end this problem. Like any humanitarian help, it's important, but the best humanitarian aid that we can have is just ending the Maduro regime. And I think that the OAS is the best institution at this point who have been helping us with that.
I concur with those comments, and I would say there's another group called Foro Penal, a Venezuelan organization that has chronicled human rights abuses, and which the OAS has used in building its referral to the International Criminal Court against that government. And I think that this is that would be a really important group, particularly for the Federalist Society, to take a look at because of its commitment to the rule of law as an essential part of restoring democratic institutions. And
I'm sorry, Ambassador, the first word is foro, and what's after that?
Penal, P-E-N-A-L.
Penal, okay, great.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree too.
Okay, the next question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Gino. I am calling in from Dallas, Texas. Where would each of you predict if or when the U.S. might begin to conduct military operations? Emphasis on if. Would it be Maduro unwilling to stand down? Would talks between the government and opposition break down? Or senior members of opposition being arrested? What do each of you think?
I'm going to defer to the Venezuelans first.
Oh, well, that's a very tough question. I don't know. According to my opinion, there is an asymmetrical war that's going to be, it's going to take time for me. Because although people believe that the regime is weak, sure, but isn't weak enough in order to say that, well, it's going to be broken tomorrow, or even they are waiting time with the dialogue and the negotiation. As always, they are surviving day by day, and there is still more fear in the population. I don't know. It's hard to say that when it's going to finish. I would like to say tomorrow, but I don't think so that it's going to be in the coming days and maybe months. I don't know.
Yes, so let me jump in. I didn't mean to throw the hot potato to you, but I think that the conditions that you mentioned would be potentially contributing factors, breakdown of the so-called dialogue, but certainly a massive crackdown, use of violence against people, or some kind of incursion into Colombian territory. By the way, I believe the Colombian government has a casus belli already in terms of the presence of the narco guerrilla groups operating with impunity in Venezuela. You know, certainly that kind of a conventional threat against an American ally could induce a response. But I think it's a dangerous situation precisely because the regime will, I don't think, will take that bait. I don't think the regime will do those things that would provoke the that sort of justifiable response. We're going to need to, I think, retool our policy and work to challenge the regime on the ground in Venezuela.
I want to jump in with the math, with some math to this equation. I think as long as escaping from Venezuela or becoming a refugee is easier than bringing down the dictatorship, people will prefer, will have to decide to choose to escape. As long as it's easier to put all the political prisoners, all the political politicians in prison, is easier than bringing down the dictatorship. I think that is what is going to happen to a politician. Without a position and a people ready to fight, I don't see a solution inside the country. So again, there have to be something that needs to change that equation that will make more costly for them to do whatever they want. Because so far, you know, just beyond some sanction from the U.S., there is no any penalty for their actions. I remember when they tried to introduce the humanitarian aid some month ago, and we couldn't, and then nothing happened. There was like this meeting of all members of the Latin American continent, and they just condemned what just happened. But there's not, nothing that will affect directly. Every time they kill someone, put someone in prison, you know, that equation is working against us. And that's why we're losing power every day.
If I can suggest a possible trigger that didn't happen, I was personally shocked by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights report that said that there had been several thousand extrajudicial killings, that the government... the government forces would go in and they'd fire machine gun bullets against a wall to make it look as though the victims had resisted, and then they would simply engage in mass slaughter of people who had not themselves committed violence. I really thought there was going to be a bigger international reaction to that than there has been. Would there need to be something else like that? Would there need to be another massacre in order to galvanize international forces to do whatever it is they're going to do?
Well, I was alluding to, by the way, a situation where there would be a mobilization of people again to challenge the regime, and there would be brutal repression against them in the streets, which would cause some sort of a public revulsion and reaction. Again, I think the regime with their Cuban handlers are advising them how to avoid this kind of provocative display of force. They're perfectly content with driving people quietly out of the country, anybody with any energy leaving the country, abandoning the country.
Well, that's what I thought until I saw this report. And of course, it wasn't 4,000 people all killed in one day. It was over a period of time. But apparently, they're not doing it publicly in the streets, but they are engaging in massive extrajudicial killing as well as torture. And the report goes into detail, electric shock, sexual violence against women, those kinds of things. Anybody have another further reaction on the questioner's question or my follow-up?
Well, I believe that the report, it was surprising. But again, what is also surprising, there is no response from the international community after something like that. So basically, like, there is something that is not working in the system, and it looks like only a strong image where it's helping will help to explain that we need to act. So basically, it's like the international community is waiting for another disaster, another massacre, in order to maybe do something more. But, you know, the people are dying every day because of the scarcity of food. This doesn't go too well into the media because it's something that happened very slowly. So basically, yeah, I'm worried about the pace of the international community. But again, I'm even more worried that we are talking about, I don't know, military actions when we haven't seen other type of action that are easier for the continent and not being done. So, you know, I even see far away any type of those actions that, you know, that are stronger when the easy one haven't been applied to Venezuela at this point. So, yes, maybe we just need to wait for more pressure. Maybe countries are waiting that their borders will collapse, like in Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, in order to raise their voice to the level that they understand that they need to do something more and stop, really stop what is happening. I was surprised that this week the Pope, they haven't spoken too much of Venezuela. Even the Pope have just said that the tragedy in Venezuela must end, that we need to find a solution. For the first time that he publicly made this statement that we need to resolve the crisis in Venezuela, that this crisis can't continue like this. And this is very important, a message to the Catholic world, and I hope this will have the consequence at some point in political actors. But again, we have been doing everything we can do as human rights activists. And I don't know, next week I will be in Brussels advocating and talking with the European Union and the European Parliament about doing something against the regime right now. But I don't have too many high hopes that we will see a quick response for Venezuela.
We're running out of time. I would like to give, if we can, Colonel Ochoa and Ambassador Noriega each 1 minute to summarize or to add any final thoughts.
Well, I think that the problem is not just from the Venezuelans only. There is a regional problem. And there is not only to the Maduro regime out, but there is the main goal, I think, is to stop the Bolivarian Revolution to spread all the region.
Ambassador Noriega.
Yes. One of the panelists referred to a man named Hugo Carvajal, who is a general of the Venezuelan military, deeply involved in narco trafficking. Another mentioned Christopher Figueroa, another general deeply involved in human rights abuses. These people are being presented by our State Department as evidence that there is room for bringing about change in Venezuela. If these people are supposed to represent change, we're in very serious trouble. I will say one final point on negotiations that are going on right now. We don't know who's leading these negotiations on the part of our side, whatever side that is. There are no clear red lines. There are no clear objectives. And I'm afraid that it'll produce some sort of an agreement for another round of phony elections, which the regime will use to consolidate power, to bleed off international pressure, and get sanctions lifted. That right now is the looming problem.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, and thanks to our other panelists. I think that's all the time we have.
Well, Ambassador and all of our panelists, thank you so much from the Federal Society as well. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank each of you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.